Next up, we have Eve Bahar. Eve has been notorious in the design world for a very long time, so much so that Boré actually studied him while he was at college. He's also been visiting Milan Design Week for many years, since the early noughties, and so he tells us how the Design Week is changing and what he sees for the future.
All right, let's do this. Born ready, we would say, yeah. But first of all, thank you, Eve, for coming. And yet another start of a podcast. Very excited that you're here. Well, I just mentioned the untalkable, but it's not the untalkable. It's more the things that we don't really say or the things that we don't really talk about, especially in a week like Milan Design Week, where all brands are polished up, put on their best coats, and are there to show their newest, I wanted to say poop that they shitted out, because a sort of it is not necessary that it's there, but it is a space where we all come together. So it is a space where conversations can happen. But I'm very happy to have you here. I wanted to actually ask a very easy start to do a small introduction. You have done so much throughout the years. Well, even that when I was going to design school, I was looking at you being on stage, you pushing the boundaries of technology, you bringing technology on and around the body, introducing new technologies for light to the world in shape. But most of all, actually, our small conversation that we had the other morning, luckily we're staying at the same friend, that's lucky, very us. Nice. Very lucky us. I was very intrigued by how you said, looking at the place where you are now, the place how you are with your old company and how you're looking at the new. So maybe a small introduction for that, and then we go on from there.
Sure. Well, I'm Eve Bahar. I founded Fuse Project 25 years ago. And I've been coming here to Milan since early 2000s as well. So I've seen a lot of it. I still come. I think it's a pretty fantastic kind of endurance exercise, you know, for people from all around the world. I call it the Burning Man of design. Because after day one, you're already tired and you got to keep going and keep going. I was lucky to be able to buy Fuse Project back about 6 months ago. The impetus for that was I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. And I may as well be in control and pursue the things that I'm interested in and be of support to companies who want to, you know, have great intent and want to make a positive change. So that's me kind of re-energized, I guess, and with a feeling like the next 20 years are going to be the best 20 years. So let's do it.
What an opening statement. I'd love to share your optimism around the next 20 years. There's certainly that opportunity. I think I've been coming to Milan Design Week almost as long. And you mentioned Burning Man there. And I have, over the last few years, wished it was more like Burning Man, in the respect that organizations coming together to skill share and intel share and genuinely think about alternatives to the way that we're living, mm-hmm. and the way that we will live in the next 20 years and how much has to change. The interesting thing about the unsaid or the unspeakable, one thing that we don't speak a lot about is death. And in fact, in the UK, we do not die well. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's often seen as a failure of some sort. But one thing that we were speaking about in preparing for this conversation was a model that I found incredibly inspiring on a course I did last year called the Bio Leadership Fellowship, which is run by Andres Roberts. Shout out to them. They're incredible. And they basically teach leaders how to introduce nature into their practice. But one of this model is the two loops model. And it recognizes that in nature, systems grow and then they fail. And as they fail, they decompose and they create the nutrients for new systems to emerge. And there's so many systems that need to fail, but we're not really allowing them to. Political systems, economic systems, they're kind of becoming very brittle, but they're not quite breaking. And I suppose in opening, I'd like to ask you, as someone who's been incredibly successful in the old world, thinking about as we move into a new world and what the next 20 years might bring, you know, how do you see this point for yourself? Are you willing to let things die and release yourself and sacrifice for those next 20 years?
Well, I would say, you know, what you're talking about is change. And, you know, I live in a world of constant change, which is, you know, the Valley, San Francisco, where, you know, you try things, you try many things, and some of them succeed, some of them fail. I've been a part of 90 plus startups in the last 15, 20 years. And the ideas need to be tried. The ideas need to be given a chance. And sometimes they make it, sometimes they don't. And in terms of the old systems needing to change, I feel that, you know, startups kind of die pretty quickly of a natural, you know, like of a natural death. Old systems tend to be put on ventilators that kind of keep them alive, maybe past their use. And, you know, the big challenge in the next 25 years is how to really either transform existing infrastructure, such as the NHS and the healthcare system, transform them radically into something that works better. I think in some ways, AI is going to be a part of that. And, you know, we see that, for example, with the car companies. Clearly, the traditional car companies are not adapting to the new world, to the EV world, to a more sustainable, you know, mode of transportation. And the ones that are thriving are the new car companies. And even when the big car companies try, like GM, you know, GM tried in the U.S. tried to make a bunch of electric cars, and they recently made an announcement that, you know, they're not having success with it. And it's not because EVs are not the future. It's because they cannot meet the expectations of a consumer. They cannot transform themselves fast enough for what's needed. And so, you know, it reminds me of a trip I made in Africa about 15 years ago. I guess I had to be there to realize that in nature, there's no happy death. There's no calm way to, you know, you started with death, so I'm going to finish with it. And there's no calm way to finish. In nature, the way, it doesn't matter what kind of beautiful life, that doesn't matter whether you're the king of the jungle, the biggest lion or the biggest elephant or the strongest rhino, you end up being eaten. That's the laws of nature. And so I believe that the big companies, if they don't change, if they don't transform themselves radically, they'll end up being eaten by the startups and the new companies thinking in new ways and meeting customers and meeting demand in these new ways.
Beautifully put.
Sure. I think it's very literal and very and very sort of the effect. And I hope it is. But there's one thing, of course, that we created, and that's a financial system. And a lot of the startups have to grow and evolve and blossom within a financial system that is not built for them. It's not built for balance. It's built for linear growth. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that, linear growth doesn't exist in nature. It is not, oh yeah, we build and build and build. It's the loop that we started mm-hmm. with. And how do you see that if you're, because you, and what I found very interesting, and that's from our conversation that we had when we both arrived at the home, but you said, in my company that I bought back in Silicon Valley, we do projects that are related to bigger companies and that are mm-hmm. financially viable. Mm-hmm. But I can't start always conversations and projects that are not financially viable. So I had to set something up for that.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit more about how you look at that and what you're doing with that?
Well, about 20 years ago, I started a practice within my studio called Venture Design. And, you know, I learned a lot about how to create interest first in the, you know, in the creative sense, you know, for to build something, and then first how to create interest in a financial sense so other people will invest, and then finally creating interest by an audience, you know, finding what's called product market fit, so a product makes it out there. And each of these are incredibly difficult, incredibly painful, and at the same time, for me, incredibly addictive. I mean, I can't do anything that is more exciting than that, besides surfing big waves. But I can't do anything that is more exciting than that, because once you are acquainted with risk and potential reward, that becomes exciting. And, you know, the big corporate world is kind of static. It's not moving. And so, you know, the pain that you have to go through at times not being supported or not being understood or your ideas being dismissed within this sort of startup world, you realize it is a part of it. You know, you get up in the morning and you have the swing of emotions from morning to night that go from complete elation, everything's fantastic, like we're going to make it, you know, everyone loves what we do, to despair because something negative happens, back to elation, back to despair. It's a constant, you know, swing of emotions. And part of doing startups, and I think what I've learned over the years, because initially it would hit me really hard. It would, like, you know, you put your heart and soul into these things. So you want every single one to succeed. But you realize that, you know, even within a startup, within a single venture, those up and downs are needed, because they allow you to react, to change your mind, to adjust, maybe to persevere, maybe to take another turn. And eventually, you know, through this back and forth, maybe you get somewhere. And if you don't, you start something else. And I just find it something I can't live without now. And I think there is really two types of human beings. You know, the majority of human beings are comfortable within an environment that is predictable and continuous. And others really find their drive, you know, what excites them through adversity. And now I know I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, and it hits me a little bit less hard. So if there's anything I can say to you, is just be patient, you know, be patient and kind of roll with it, because every part that's a setback, there is an opportunity to move forward at some point. And sometimes forcing things or being impatient or hard on yourself isn't really helping. You know, those cycles happen, whether you get dramatic or whether you get, you know, whether you beat yourself up or not, the cycle of positive and negative is going to continue. So you may as well, you know, ride the bottoms and enjoy the tops.
Ride the wave and ride it out sometimes.
Yes.
I'm interested in the two types of people that you see, you know, because this illusion, which is what it actually is, of like predictability or safety, it's never actually that,
no.
Is it? And I think there's maybe those who recognize that and are comfortable about the unpredictable. I mean, you mentioned you used to come to Milan Design Week, and in fact, you walked out of a club one time and it was snowing.
Yes.
Like, and when we think about, you know, that, like, it's unpredictable. But
now
increasingly,
Milan is full spring.
Yeah, exactly. Know? So climate change is making it nicer weather, I suppose. But actually, what's happening over time is, you know, if you think about the way that humans have evolved, if you go back hundreds of years, we are increasingly understanding ourselves in relationship to the world better, because it's unavoidable the impact we're having on the planet at the moment. We understand ourselves not to be separate from it, but entangled with it, and actually very detrimental currently in the way things are going. And I'd love to know your thoughts on relationships, specifically to technology,
mm-hmm.
You know, to understand that if technology is going to play a role in the future, it will be different to the relationship that we've had in the past, because it's not us as separate to technology and us using it as a tool so much as us in relationship with it and nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that as a necessary reframing of the way that we see ourselves, entangled multitudes in relationship with many different things simultaneously. All humans are going to have to get very comfortable with that perception. And it's as a profound an evolution of consciousness than the Enlightenment in some respects.
Sure.
But it has to happen quickly. So when you're building new things and you're creating new startups, do you think about our relationship to the world or their relationship and how to build integrity into the way they're going to grow?
Absolutely. I mean, technology is just a tool. It's just a material, you know, just like fabric, just like wood. And if we, and we can do good things with fabric or wood, or we can do terrible things with fabric. You know, we can make a noose to hang people with fabric, right? To use that example.
Death again. That will keep on coming back.
No, because that's critical. And I work with founders that are sort of incredibly humanistic. You know, I worked with a founder who is over 70 years old, who's been a pediatrician his entire life, I mean, a well-known one, and we created, you know, basically a robot that takes care of your baby. That sounds terrifying, but it turns out it's the Snoo, the happiest baby Snoo, who is helping families and lowering the, I mean, and eliminating the instance of SIDS and you know, allowing parents and babies to sleep more and sleep better. So what is the intent? I mean, that's what design is. Design is the first sign of human intent. And what I'm positive about these days is, you know, when I look at the technology that's been dominating, I would say, the conversation for the last 15 plus years, which is social media, I don't think the intent of that technology is humanistic. It was in the beginning, but it lost control of that notion. And it's exploitative, and it's extremely detrimental to our focus on things like nature and the world and each other. And it's been extremely detrimental to adults, teenagers, and kids. But now I feel like AI actually has founders that are a lot more conscious, and that I have a sort of a first view at that, right? I meet them all the time, you know, in France, in England, in the US, in Israel. And I meet all these founders that have genuine, you know, reasons for using these technologies in a way that is a positive, you know, in the medical field, in brain health, in, you know, mental well-being, in the home, in, you know, caring for the aging. So in all these areas, we have founders that are designing, rather than designing generalist technologies that the largest number of people should use because it's good for advertising and that's their business model, right? They're designing things for specific humans at specific times of their lives because, you know, if I'm old, if I'm sick, if I have learning disabilities, I need specific tools that work with me personally. And these founders are designing these, conceiving of these technologies, and it's incredible to partner with them because they're incredibly, incredibly humanistic and positive about the impact of their technologies. Mm. So that's my responsibility as a designer, to pick the projects and the founders and to put myself out there at the service of positive outcomes for, you know, for the new technologies that we use, whether they're materials, whether they're tech-based products, whether they're new services.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? The I think that coming as you do from the kind of background close to Silicon Valley and thinking about what happened there in terms of, it felt like there was enlightened leaders that were coming through the organizations in the 70s that really got it and understood what was happening. And the door felt like it was firmly slammed shut on that. And it feels like I'd love to share your optimism of this being a second age of the Aquarius, where we are truly, you know, going to recreate everything. But in order to do that, it will actually require us not to see, you know, wood as resource or technology as just a tool. you used the word consumer in you know, close to our opening, and I must admit that word has become quite triggering for me, only because I read a book called Citizens by John Alexander last year. And like in it, he asked the question, he's very successful in the advertising industry, but asked himself the question, what are we doing to ourselves when we call ourselves consumer 3,000 times a day?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I use the word consumer because in a way, in that particular area, you know, voting with your money or with your attention is also important.
Yes.
So, you know, sometimes I use the word wearer, you know, when we were doing a lot of body trackers, etc., I was calling them, you know, the wearers of our products, or users, or, you know, or just people. But I agree with your premise, but I also feel that individuals have a responsibility. And I know full-grown adults who complain about their sleep, and yet they leave their phone on at night. I'm like, what are you doing? You don't even have the, I don't know, the self-discipline to turn off your phone at night. So why are you complaining? Of course, technologies are responsible for grabbing our attention and turning it into a business model. But we also have a role to play in that. And in a way, you know, a lot of these technologies and a lot of design is addressing the comfortable middle part of life. When you're healthy, when you are, you know, when you can afford things, etc. And I'm actually interested in the extremes parts of life. You know, when you're a baby, when you're an aging adult, when you're in a healthcare system, when you're learning, when you're having challenges. And I think design needs to address more of that. Mm. And I think that's when maybe we can kind of reconcile ourselves with the work that we're doing and where the world will go.
I find that very interesting and intriguing, and actually like immediately thinking like, well, we need to build way harder and realistic mirrors for everybody, because it is all about comfort and being pampered, and all design is like, oh, don't worry about it, we'll fix it for you. And oh yeah, if you don't sleep, well, we'll have a pill for that. And if you cannot walk, well, we'll help you with a wheelchair. And if you cannot do this, we'll have something for it. Where the realization that we are human, and the realization that everything is in our body to consume, to move, to, and that's all about learning, training, and mm-hmm. and the dialogue. It's almost the reality check that we are human and that we are part of nature. And instead of that, we are separate and we are entitled to have everything and everything to be done for us.
Sure. I mean, all ancient and native philosophies are always about how we are a part of nature, how we are not separate from it. But in our civilization, first religion separated us, the Industrial Revolution separated us from nature, and, you know, at some point, there needs to be a larger realization that our destiny is dependent on that relationship, being being restored in a way. And so what I would say also is, and the reason why I sound optimistic is because I read a fantastic book called The Ministry for the Future. The author's last name is Stanley Robinson. It's a New York Times bestseller. And if you haven't read it, it's an absolute must, because it doesn't deny the catastrophes that are about to happen. It's a near future. It's not science fiction. It's science. It's near future. It's not denying that we're facing catastrophe, and some of these catastrophes are going to happen. What it's showing is, what do we do when that happens? How do humans organize themselves? What are the challenges in doing so? And, you know, we have all the sciences and all the, you know, ideas are here. It's just that we're not applying them, and we won't apply them in an international, global way until we're absolutely confronted by, you know, by environmental catastrophes. But it gave me a lot of hope, because a lot of what we have today are the solutions of tomorrow. And it is a matter of applying them. So if you read that book, it's neither utopian nor dystopian. It's realistic, but it gave me a lot of clarity about what needs to get done.
Beautiful.
I'm not going to give away the rest of the book because I want people to read it.
Yeah, I look forward to reading it.
Yeah, very beautiful. I think it's, and I almost want to bring it back to death, because it is almost that we only realize the last moment. If it's movies or if you speak to people that come close to death, the realization how close you are to nature, how close you are to human, and then start to question what is actually very important.
Yeah.
And only if we start with that.
But I wonder if I could ask a question of all three of us.
Okay, sure.
Which is, what advice would you give yourself from your deathbed?
So I've been trying to imagine that a few times, and you know what, you hear the same things, right, from a lot of people. There's actually some really interesting podcasts or some studies that have been made with people that were much older or closer to death, and it's always the same. It's always, I wish I had worked less. I wish I had spent more time with my kids. I wish I had given myself more freedom and more credit and more self-love. And I think all those things are true. Unless, like me, you love your work and I'm going to die at my desk, you know? But that's because it's the energy I try to put back in the world. But all of the above is true. And we all need to try to be aware of this, I think, while we're healthy and happy and alive.
I think that's exactly like following the energy that, giving the energy that you want to get back, and just follow it. Because and that's probably when also the situations where I'm in now, but to not be, don't be afraid for big structures that are there, that seem to be like more important or stronger than your own feeling and opinion. So following that, I think.
I think self actualization is real. I feel like so often in my life, I thought something was not possible, or I couldn't do it, or I was too shy to do it, or I was too afraid. And you know, once you kind of rid yourself of fear, you can actually just kind of flow towards learning. And I think most of the time, fear of something is a fear of learning. Fear of learning how to, you know, be better in the world, or to take on bigger challenges, or to share how you feel about someone. We're fearful creatures. And if you try to push that away, you can make progress.
Beautifully put. I think I would probably answer the question of what I would say to myself from my deathbed differently every day. But today I was thinking of something that you said to me after I asked you about Elephant in the Room last year, and you said I could not do it. And actually, I think that would be my advice to myself, which echoes what you've just said. Like, don't not say it. Don't not do it.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
Thank you. I think that's a beautiful end. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eve. I found that conversation incredibly inspiring and hopeful for the next 25 years. Next up, we have Jakob Lang from Big Architecture. He's in Milan Design Week as Big have worked on the Audi Pavilion here. But he also talks about how so many of the innovations that are key to the path forward are already around us. Enjoy the conversation.